Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Hi, everyone. This is a super special show tonight. The listeners let us know how much they like our history shows, with or without aliens. Tonight is just regular history. Tomorrow at noon Eastern, Barbara and Andrew Collins will be discussing his new book on the first female pharaoh. Most of our shows are reviews of books we enjoy, and both of us have authors return to our shows over our dozen years of broadcasting, and we're friends with the authors. But rarely do hosts get a chance to interview authors of their favorite book. No, Poe and Dickens aren't guests tonight, but we do have Dr. Jonathan Lothorpe, Lisa Dugas, and John Bowlidge. All did contribute to my favorite book, and title is Panhandle Archaic Americans in the Upper Ohio Valley, Archaeological Data Recovery at the East Steubenville and Highland Hills Sites, West Virginia Route 2, Follins B. Weirton Road Upgrade Project, Brooke County, West Virginia. And they all worked on this fascinating East Steubenville dig about 20 years ago and went on to have stellar careers in archaeology. And they've also been very supportive in a collaborative project I've been doing with several local museums. And I think they're just terrific, researchers and scholars. They've really meant a lot to me, so it's really fantastic to have them here on Nightlight. So, I just want to introduce Jonathan, John, and Lisa. Say hi to everyone.
Good evening.
Hello. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Okay. Jonathan is a curator of archaeology at the New York State Museum in Albany and has many publications on the Paleo-Indians and archaic cultures. And he was the principal investigator of the East Steubenville and Highland Hills sites. Lisa is the division leader for cultural resources for the Big Pine Consultants in Pittsburgh. And John is an archaeologist with the Ohio Department of Natural Resources and the Village Blacksmith at Fort Steubenville, Ohio. And John was on WTOV last week and now making his debut on Nightlight. So he's becoming a multimedia superstar. So
thanks.
Yeah, you know, we don't need to hear about the Pirates of the Caribbean recounted. Okay, maybe we should start with Jonathan. May have like four questions all kind of like rolled into one that could kind of get us started on so many aspects of archaeology and you know, what it takes to work on a dig and have a career as an archaeologist. So, okay. Aside from being really good at what you do, how did you get the East Steubenville job? How do you begin assembling your various crews, like, you know, in the field, in the lab, you know, writing, dealing with the previous excavations, and why is the East Steubenville site a textbook case for how to conduct a dig?
Well, that's a bunch of questions, Mark, and I'll try to answer them. So just a little background to this. There are environmental laws that were passed back in the 1960s and 70s that led to the for requiring projects that have federal oversight or federal funding to take into account effects on both environmental resources like wetlands, but also important cultural resources like archaeological sites or significant architectural buildings and so forth. And so that was the legal framework that drove this work and this particular project. The work took place back in the archaeological work took place back in the around 1998, 99, 2000, and West Virginia Division of Highways was planning to upgrade Route 2, which runs along the east side of the Ohio River in the vicinity of the city of Steubenville. And it was known from previous work by an archaeologist, William Meyer Oakes, who published his research back in the mid-1950s, that there was an important and significant site called East Steubenville on a ridgetop just above Route 2. And the plans called for in expanding that road, it was going to necessarily eliminate the archaeological site. And so they went through a process working with the State Historic Preservation Office, the Division of Highways did, confirming what was there, and some initial testing by a consultant indicated that there were two sites on a ridgetop overlooking Route 2. It's called McKim Ridge, and there were two sites, East Steubenville, and then just to the north of that, another site called Highland Hills. And in 1999, the Division of Highways asked the company that all three of us, Lisa, John Bowlidge, and myself worked for at the time, GAI Consultants, which is based in Pittsburgh, they asked us to mitigate the effects of the construction that was going to essentially destroy the site by conducting a focused investigation there to recover artifacts and archaeological materials from the site before it was destroyed, and then analyze that material, produce a report, and then ultimately send the archaeological materials to Grave Creek Mound, which is a state repository for West Virginia. And so we knew that this was a major site, and just in a nutshell, it consists, the Steubenville site consists of a what's called a Shellman site, where one of the most obvious features of this site, which is just below the surface, is the remains of freshwater mussels, which were collected in the river 4,000 to 5,000 years ago, carried up this steep ridge spur to the site and cooked and consumed there during a number of encampments by these early Native Americans who were living in the Upper Ohio Valley 5,000 to 4,000 years ago. And so we knew that was an extensive and important site. And we also knew there was another site just north of it, and I said the Highland Hill site. And so we pulled together a team of archaeologists and field technicians and other specialists that we thought we would likely need their assistance on in analyzing all the archaeological materials we expected to come out of the site that reflected the lifeway of these people who were seasonally camping at this ridge spur setting overlooking the Ohio River. So stone tools of various types, food remains, animal bones, shellfish, plant remains, and so forth, and other specialist analysts who are going to study those materials and help us understand and interpret those remains. So in a nutshell, that's how we ended up assembling and starting this project. That the fieldwork began in the fall of 1999 and continued through the fall of 2020.
Okay, and you met with William Meyer Oakes as well, and worked with the Carnegie Museums. Yeah, that was what the major museum in the area. So, Jonathan, you're dealing with them, it seems like, on a regular basis.
Well, I didn't meet with William Meyer Oakes initially. I did meet him later. And William Meyer Oakes was a very important archaeologist who worked all over North America and Canada. And one of his first jobs after the war was to work at the Carnegie Museum. And that's when he did his excavations at various sites, not at East Steubenville, but he knew about the East Steubenville site from artifacts that avocational archaeologists had picked up on the site through their own informal excavations. And so he really was the first person to try and understand the long human history of Native American occupation in the Upper Ohio Valley. And he published a book in 1995 called The Prehistory of the Upper Ohio Valley. And in there, he talked about the East Steubenville site and had some very perceptive insights and interpretations on the site. But he wrote about the whole span of Native American prehistory in the Upper Ohio Valley from 13,000 to 12,000 years ago up until the contact of indigenous peoples with colonizing European populations. So he kind of laid the groundwork, really, for every archaeologist who worked in the Upper Ohio Valley since then. The Carnegie Museum was his employer for about 15 years, I believe, before he then went off to work in Canada. And so that's the key role that the Carnegie played in this investigation.
Okay. John, you were there for basically the full year that the excavations were going on. you're finding some, the various arrowheads. What are you learning about the people who were living on this unusual hillside?
Well, that's a big question. I'll start with just talking a little bit about how we approached our investigation. So we knew that on this ridge spur that runs north-south, overlooking the Ohio River, and the ridge spur is about 250 to 300 feet above the river. So it's a very commanding view of the location. We knew we had two large sites there. But we needed more detail on the extent and position of these two sites. And each of them consisted of a near-surface distribution of Native American artifacts and food refuse and so forth. And so what we did was we did a series of close-interval small tests called shovel tests about every 50 feet across this ridge spur landform. And what that showed was that these two sites were extremely large. Highland Hills was situated further north, and East Steubenville was situated further south on the south end of this ridge spur. Both of these sites were roughly two football fields in length. So these are very large sites, and that's part of the reason the investigation took so long, is the sites themselves were so extensive. But once we had a sense of the limits of each of these sites, and they were really right next to each other, one further north, the second one, East Steubenville, further south, then we had a sense of the internal distribution generally of artifacts, and that's when we started opening up block excavations to more intensively sample the archaeological material that was there. We started recovering a range of stone tools, the projectile points that these people used, which were of two types, one's called Brewerton points and one's called Steubenville points, and those date respectively to about, Brewerton points date to about 6,000 to 5,000 years ago, and the Steubenville points date to about 4,500 to 3,500 years ago. And that told us that there was a long history of occupation at this site, perhaps with several centuries of the site not being a focus of Native American encampment. And then we began recovering a range of artifacts, other kinds of stone tools made by percussion flaking from chert cobbles, things like drills for working hide and bone, scraping tools, these square scraping tools for working hide, and then a variety of other kinds of stone tools, many of them ground stone tools that were hafted, like adzes and axes and celts for woodworking, and cobble tools, which were being used as hammer stones for flaking the chert that they were bringing to the site during the encampment. And then we began recovering a whole range of food remains that these people left behind that told us about the diets and the lifeways and how they were literally making a living 5,000 to 6,000 years ago in this part of the Upper Ohio Valley.
Okay, cool. Okay, we got a really good background. So I have a question for John Bowledge. Okay, John, so you're there on the hillside and on top of the hill. What are you doing? Are you finding some of the different types of points? Are you helping to identify what types of church they're made from?
Well, on that particular job, I was hired as crew.
so my job at East Steubenville there, I came on the job very early on in that initial phase where we did the shovel testing to kind of delineate, you know, the size of the site and where the different sites, you know, kind of met and or didn't meet. You know, so I was brought on for that. And then later on, I ended up, like most of the crew there, I ended up, you know, spending the entire excavation there that entire year up there, roughly from Thanksgiving to Thanksgiving. You know, so it was kind of interesting as a side note to spend all four seasons up there on that ridge, just to kind of get an idea of what some of those prehistoric people might have gone through as well during the seasons. But that's kind of another story. But, so that's pretty much my job there. I was a crew member and like I said, shovel testing initially, and then some of those test unit excavations and block unit excavations was what I was doing there.
Had you been really interested in archaeology prior to this experience, or you were just getting your feet wet at East Steubenville?
I had been very interested in archaeology. In fact, in the 1980s, early 1980, University of Steubenville at the time actually conducted field schools there, and I volunteered I think I was 10 or 12 year old there, so I actually had a little bit of experience at East Steubenville prior to going back there, working in a much more detailed fashion. So I was really excited about that. I got to work there as a volunteer as a kid. My interest in archaeology continued and grew, and eventually I got to go back there as an archaeologist and got to work there. So it was kind of for me personally, it was an interesting sort of full circle sort of experience for me.
Okay, and Lisa, Jonathan mentioned, yeah, the shell midden. Okay. Can you give, you know, you're the one of the shell experts there. Can you describe a little bit about the midden and all the types of shells? That seems like it was the most salient feature of the site.
Yeah, the midden was pretty extensive. So while we were there, excavating, we identified kind of the limit of the shell midden, which was essentially flanked the site on the side ridges. And there were some really extensive deposits, and we identified separate lenses. There was also a good bit of looting up there, so we hit a bit of disturbance from the looters that disrupted the midden feature as a whole. But while we were excavating there, we identified these large pit features inside the midden that were just packed with shell. And whenever we had those features, we collected the shell from those deposits to take back and analyze in the lab. And while I was doing the shell analysis back in the lab, after the excavations were complete, and it was really very interesting because there was a lot of just broken bits of shell, but in the features, there was more intact, like whole pieces of freshwater mussel shell. So we were able to identify, I think we identified 17 different species, but there were two that were that dominated the entire collection, and that was the Elliptio dilatata, which is the spike commonly called the spike, and the Elliptiocoracidans, and that one's called the elephant ear. And those shell, you can still find them in the Ohio River, those types of freshwater mussels. They're still present in the river. So we found those, and we learned a lot from them because we were able to do some habitat reconstruction to kind of identify where we thought they were coming from in the Ohio River, and at what time they were likely being harvested. So we learned a lot about the relationship that the people at the site had with the freshwater mussels, like how important it was for their life.
Okay, so you know, basically they're having clam bakes.
Yeah, pretty much. they're collecting these shell. They're going down to the Ohio River at the confluence of Mahan Run, I think it is, and in like a fast, swift water area, but relatively shallow. And they're going out and they're collecting them and they're taking them all the way back up the hill. I think it's a pretty steep incline to climb that hill with, you know, I would imagine basketfuls or bagfuls of freshwater mussel. And then they're baking them in these large pits. We also did some experiments up there to kind of replicate what we thought might be happening in terms of how they were processing the freshwater mussels. So we did, we created our own pit, and we steamed some mussels, and then we created a kind of platform hearth where we cooked mussels just straight in the fire. So from our experiments, we figured that, yeah, they're definitely, well, they're most likely steaming the freshwater mussels to open them and extract the meat.
Okay. So Lisa, did you cook for the crew in this experiment? Was it delicious, disgusting?
We did not eat them, but we did contemplate eating them. But the folks who collected the shell for us from the Ohio River down at the Greenup Pool, which is kind of near Point Pleasant on the Ohio River, they recommended that we... Yes, exactly. Mothman country. They recommended that we don't eat them because they were in a pretty contaminated area. So, yeah, they said it probably wouldn't be a good idea to do that. But we've read historic accounts kind of compared to chewing gum in terms of the texture. So they're supposed to be pretty rubbery.
So... Jocko, just come back to you. So, in several parts of the midden, there were a few burials found on, like, the lower two-thirds of the hillside. Were you expecting to encounter burials? How did the exhumation change how you approached doing this? Proceeding with the excavation.
Before I talk about that, Mark, I just want to follow up on what Lisa had to say. And the thing that's perhaps most significant about the East Steubenville site is it's the first, it's not the only evidence, but it's the first identified evidence of a fundamental shift in Native American lifeways in the Upper Ohio Valley. We know that Native Americans come into the region shortly after 13,000 years ago during the Ice Age. They're hunter-gatherers. And after the end of the Ice Age, about 11,500 years ago, they continued that lifeway until about 5,000 years ago or so, when they start to exploit in a significant way the riverine resources of the Ohio River. And that by that I'm talking about both shellfish and fish. And that's a fundamental change in how these people were literally making a living, because before that, they were essentially subsisting from 13,000 years ago to perhaps 5,000 years ago. They're subsisting strictly as hunter-gatherers exploiting terrestrial fauna, hunting in the Ice Age. They might have been hunting caribou. After the Ice Age, they were probably hunting deer and elk, and gathering wild plant foods. And then 5,000 years ago, there's this fundamental shift in their lifeway, where they turn towards the river. And that's what's so well documented at the East Steubenville site. And Meyer Oakes realized that when he first wrote about the site back in 1955. But the data recovery excavations that we did in 1999 and 2000, Lisa, John, and our other colleagues, that recovered these very large samples of shell from these intact features, as Lisa mentioned. That provided the basis for her and her colleague Harold Rollins from University of Pittsburgh to study both the habitat and the procurement of these shellfish. And the other thing I just want to point out before turning to the human remains at the site is that the soils in the Upper Ohio Valley are typically acidic, and so that has important repercussions for investigating Native American archaeological sites. And the older the site is in general, the less likely you're going to have preservation of organic artifacts of bone and wood and so forth, but it also means it's less likely that you're going to have preservation of food remains because they're simply destroyed in the acidic soils. But when you have a site with a shell midden on it of discarded freshwater mussel shell, what that does is that shell buffers the acidity in the soil, and you end up with a site like East Steubenville where, because of the buffered soil acidity, other kinds of food remains, especially animal bone, are often very well preserved. And so there was a whole suite of other kinds of food remains, terrestrial food remains in particular, which we can talk about a little later, that were preserved because of the presence of that shell buffering the soil acidity. So in terms, turning to the human remains, we had been working at the site, I think we had started in October, and about a month later, we encountered a Native American burial in a pit on the east side of the ridge flank. And by the end of the field investigation, we'd encountered a total of six Native American burials. And that was, we knew it was a possibility, but we really didn't have any expectation about how likely that would be. And on a project like this, which is as we talked about, is a so-called Section 106 project. It's subject to Section 106 regulations of the National Historic Preservation Act. When you encounter human remains, whether they're believed to be Native American or Euro-American, or African American, whatever the human group might be represented, you need to consult with various parties. You start off by consulting with the agency that you're working for, in this case, the Division of Highways, and then you consult with the State Historic Preservation Office in Charleston, and they, when this happened, they then facilitated a process of outreach and consultation with various stakeholders, most of whom were Native American groups in and around West Virginia. Some of these, there are no federally recognized Native American nations in West Virginia, but there are Native American groups there, and there are federally recognized tribes outside of West Virginia that claim parts of the state as their homeland, for example, the Eastern Band Cherokee. So that resulted in a lengthy process of consultation to inform them about these discoveries of these Native American remains in these burials and to consult with them about how to best proceed going forward in terms of whether to excavate these and whether or not to analyze them to generate insights on the people themselves and to literally put a face on the people who are living at the Steubenville site. So that's how the consultation process started, and that took place over perhaps 6 months. And it was a lengthy process that you have to be inclusive in that consultation process, and both Division of Highways, the Historic Preservation Office, and our company, GAI, did everything we could to do that.
Okay, interesting. Okay, we'll return to that topic in just a minute, but John Bullidge, you and I discussed the extent of the looting, this possible 1890s
the skull
exhumation. Yeah, the skull. But there's really informative, we'll get into the color-coded maps later, but it really shows that like something like 95% of the midden had been destroyed. But since you had been working there for off and on since childhood, is there some way to determine maybe how many people were actually living there? Maybe six or seven documented examples. The skull might be about eight. Like Jonathan said, maybe if they weren't buried in the shell midden, the soil would have consumed their bodies. Is there some way to determine how many people might have been living there for?
We'll address the looting issue first.
Okay.
The East Steubenville site was known at least by folks in my region, and I'm from the Steubenville area. The East Steubenville site was known by far and wide by every collector up and down the Ohio Valley, and probably as far east and west as Columbus, Ohio, and perhaps State College, PA. I mean, everybody who had ever legally or illegally excavated at archaeological sites has or had artifacts from East Steubenville. Most of the local collectors that I have known through the years here from my region have artifacts that they claim came from East Steubenville. Now, granted, obviously some of them would have probably acquired them in a way that was probably less than reputable. Others may have bought and sold artifacts, but you know, as time went on, you know, and you get to meet some of the local collectors who are willing to share with you their collections and their some of this information. You know, it was fairly apparent that people have been systematically visiting the site and picking up artifacts for a very, very long time. And John may have to correct me on this. If I'm not mistaken, that site was first documented or listed, in the 1930s or late 1930s, if I'm correct. So people were aware of the site there. So yes, artifacts did their way off the site. And one might wonder, well, had human remains and burials been disturbed it would probably seem impossible. You know, I know of no one who has come up and said to me, you know, hey, I have human remains from that site, thank goodness, that no one's come up and said that. So, you know, that there's that. Now, you know, when you do go out and get to talk to folks who are willing to talk about their personal collections, yeah, like I said, you do see a lot of people claiming to have material from East Louisville. So it was known far and wide, and there's probably a wide distribution of artifacts from the site in private collections. Now, in the answer sort of to jump onto that next question about determination of how many people may have lived this site, incredibly difficult because, you know, it's something that I wanted to jump on too when Lisa and John were talking about the shell. I think for the folks listening, there's really no words to describe the amount of shell. There was a lot of it. So, you know, I mean, when we talk about these extensive shell middens and deposits, we mean extensive. There was a lot of material there, you know, so it really went a long way to buffering that soil. But I just kind of wanted to make that clear, you know, that there was a lot there. So now, and once again, back to that question, that would, you know, initially you might think that because the midden was so expansive that you might think that there were lots and lots and lots of people there. And that may or may not have been the case at certain times of the year, certainly. But over a long period of time, those materials are going to accumulate. So you may have had smaller groups of people visiting the site at certain times during the year over a much longer period of time, right? A couple of hundred years or so. So that's going to give that interpretation that there may have been more people than there were. That's a really difficult question. And, you know, John would like to jump in on that as well, but I don't think that it's really tough to answer a question like that. One might say that there was a decent-sized population, but remember, at these particular times in Ohio, you know, there's people here, but, I mean, we're not talking about numbers that are contemporaneous today. You know, certainly 8 or 10 people that might have been visiting that site at any given times, or a small family group or something like that over those longer periods of time could certainly produce that material there. And perhaps, you know, we're thinking of it as a different way. You know, these people might not have necessarily been staying there that whole time. This might have been a place where a lot of folks came to gather over a short period of time, you know, coming from different locations. So, you know, it's very difficult to come up with some sort of estimation on how many people were there, although I would certainly say, you know, more than a few, if that helps.
Okay. Okay.
John, you might
have
that as well.
Yeah, I would, I just following up, I think what John just said makes a lot of sense. And that's the thing about archaeology. Sometimes you can have different scenarios that end up that produce the same kind of archaeological signature. So it's conceivable that many, many people came to the East Steubenville site at any one given visit, or alternatively, it could have been smaller groups of 10 or 12 people, just one extended family even, perhaps, coming there. And if 10 or 12 people come to the site and visit it 200 times over several thousand years, that could produce the same archaeological signature as a much larger group of, say, 100 people seasonally, small bands coming together seasonally into some big macro band encampment could produce the same kind of signature. The thing that's really can't be questioned is the fact that the site itself is so large, longer than two football fields end to end. That's clear evidence that the site was visited and camped on over and over again many, many times. It was clearly an important place for one or several groups of people to come and camp there repeatedly. And so we'll never know how many people were coming, but it's in terms of the landscapes that these people were traversing in their seasonal travels, they were certainly coming there repeatedly many, many times.
Okay. Jonathan, so with, you know, the Shell Midden, you know, it kind of harkens back to William Webb's excavation of Indian Knoll and, you know, the Shell Mound Archaic people. Are we talking about the same group of people in, say, the Green River Valley and at the East Steubenville site, or are we looking at a unrelated group of people?
I'm sorry, Mark, I cut out for a second. Can you ask that question again?
Dr. Webb wrote about Indian Knoll, mm-hmm. and all the shell mounds in the Green River Valley. Was the East Steubenville site an extension of the shell mounding culture, or were they another group of people?
Well, they're all Native Americans, and that's one of the $64,000 questions, is to what extent are there perhaps cultural links or similarities in lifeways between the people in the Green River region of Kentucky and the Upper Ohio Valley of West Virginia and Ohio. So when you talk about the Green River region, that's sort of a subset of a larger group of Shell Midden sites known as the Shell Midden or Shell Mound Archaic, and that were occupied, some of them as early as 7,000 to 8,000 years ago, but and as late as 3,500 years ago. So those sites, which are also Shell Midden sites, they began to be occupied by Native Americans along major river courses in the Mid-South region of Kentucky and so forth as early as 7,000 to 8,000 years ago. And there's a question about how similar or different their lifeways were. The traditional interpretation of the Shell Mound Archaic is that it's somewhat similar to how most of us have interpreted the East Steubenville site, that this is a location that was camped on seasonally for several millennia. But there's an archaeologist, Cheryl Klassen, who over the last several decades has offered a different interpretation of the Shell Mound Archaic that views them as ceremonial centers. And this stems in part from the fact that the scale of those sites is quite different from East Steubenville. East Steubenville, the Shell Midden, was a few inches thick, and the Shell Middens at these Shell Mound Archaic sites in the Mid-South are sometimes 10 to 20 to 25 feet thick. They're just gigantic accumulations of shell. And Dr. Shaw Klassen has argued in some respects convincingly that what may be going on there is not simple repeated encampment at that those locations, but that these are actually ceremonial centers where they're conducting ritual feasting as rites of renewal, and that shell itself in that regard has important symbolic features in traditional Native American culture. The white color of shell represents purity and rebirth. And so it's, to my thinking, the Shomon Archaic is something that's very different in terms of just the scale of the archaeology. They're just gigantic accumulations of shell that are as higher than, thicker than a ranch house is high. And the scale of intensity of occupation there is almost certainly much more significantly higher than what we're looking at East Steubenville and other so-called panhandle archaic sites in northern West Virginia. So that's a larger question. We can come back to it further later, but that's to my way of thinking, what the lifeway that's represented by East Steubenville and other shell-midden sites in the Upper Ohio Valley, there's fundamental differences in size and scale that suggest differences in the number of people living at those sites and perhaps differences in what they're using those sites for.
Okay. All right. All right. Lisa, I know you wanted to talk about the honor of attending the reburial of the six people. Can you elaborate on that service?
Sure. So as a part of the project, we had the opportunity to participate in the reburial of the Native Americans that were excavated from the site. And they were buried just north on the same, well, not exactly the same landform, but north of where the site was in the same general area. And we got to participate in the reburial led by Chief Waterman. He was from the Onondaga tribe of the Seneca, or the Onondaga of the Seneca, if that's correct. John, do you remember? Is that right?
Turtle Clan of the Onondaga Nation in Central New York.
Turtle Clan of, yeah. And it was just an amazing, it was amazing to witness, you know, and we were very lucky to be invited as the archaeologists and represent, you know, the folks who were out there excavating, because it was really just a unique experience to be a part of that. Chief Waterman, he made everyone feel very welcome during the ceremony, and I believe some of his family members were there. And what we had done was we prepared the remains and wrapped them in deer skin to give back to the earth. And we put in some of the soil that was excavated from the original burial locations as well. So it was amazing to see that and to be a part of it and to watch the ceremony and to just witness that. It was really an honor to be a part of it. And then afterwards, we were all invited to participate in a feast for the dead at the Grave Creek Archaeological Complex, where members of Chief Waterman's tribe prepared a meal for us, and we all got to participate in that. It was just great. It was interesting, too, because, you know, during that ceremony, we were separated, like, because it was a matrilineal culture, and we were served, the women were served before the men, and it was just, like, interesting to see that, like, that take place. It was very, a neat thing to participate in that kind of cultural event.
Lisa, can I mention something, too?
Yeah, for sure.
You know, what Lisa was saying is absolutely true. You know, there is oftentimes archaeologists, at least at that time, weren't viewed as good people by most Native American folks. So the fact that they kind of took us in and invited us back, I mean, it was an incredible honor, and it was very sobering to be allowed to participate. And I'm going to use the word very special, at least for myself and Lisa and the other archaeologists who were there, you know, I mean, to be allowed to participate. And not only as an anthropologist, of course, to see something, you know, that you don't experience firsthand, but as a person, as someone that, you know, we weren't being looked at as archaeologists at that point. We were being looked at as just like them. And it was really, really a great positive experience.
I would agree, and I would just follow up with that. And Chief Waterman really kind of set the tone at that reburial ceremony, and it kind of what I can say is that before that, in the consultation process with these different indigenous groups, the questions being asked were, what should we do about these burials? Should they be disinterred? And if they were disinterred, should they be studied? And there was a whole range of opinions from the various Native American groups on that. Division of Highways, as the lead agency, said, look, the only way we could leave these burials in place is to not build a project. And this was viewed as a critical transportation need in that, as a Route 2 being a key corridor in the Upper Ohio Valley. And so really the only option was to excavate the burials. And then there was, we had taken input from various indigenous stakeholders on what to do, and there was agreement by most groups that there should be some study of the remains, not everything that could be done, but some basic analyses. And so any difficult feelings that may have been experienced in that consultation process, a lot of that was really kind of washed away by Chief Waterman's handling of the reburial ceremony and the subsequent feast that took place at Grave Creek later. So it was a very moving experience, and it also led to better feelings all around after as a consequence of the reburial ceremony and how it was handled, and Chief Waterman really took the lead in that regard.
That's an amazing story.
If I can just say one other thing, Mark, that reburial took place on October 6, 2001, which is literally about 2 years after the project started in the first place. So that was sort of closing the circle in terms of the investigation of the East Steubenville site.
One thing we probably add there too was that the folks were reburied not very far away from where they were originally buried, which was even a much more interesting experience. You know, that these folks an interesting journey, and then they were brought back.
Yep.
And there's a nice tribute to them on top of the hill.
Yeah, that's correct.
That's right, at the Highland Hill Cemetery.
Mm-hmm. I think this spheres are an appropriate symbol, you know, like what John was saying, you know, it's, you know, everything comes back to
circle.
You know, they really didn't go too far physically from where they were living and, you know, interred. And, you know, and you see it, it's really is a moving tribute to the people that lived there 4,000 years ago.
They got to keep the same view that they had. Just mm-hmm. a little further up the ridge, you know. But and that, me personally, I feel pretty good.
Yeah. So, Johnson, with this fantastic book that so many people contributed to. I think it's really a pioneering publication. Do you feel that the way you envisioned producing this book started some trends in publication?
Well, I think everyone involved in the project was intent on doing the best job with research, both in the field and afterwards in the laboratory analysis. Everyone was very committed to doing the best job possible, and there was sufficient funding to bring in analytical specialists, people who identified charred plant remains, a paleobotanist, Justine McKnight, Sissy Pipes, a person who identified the animal bone recovered at the site, Stephen Thomas, another faunal analyst who analyzed the fish remains from the site, staff at GAI who studied the artifacts, Lisa worked with Harold Rollins, a malacologist at University of Pittsburgh, there are just a whole bunch of individuals who contributed to the success of the project, and that was both because of the individual commitment of each of the persons working on the project. It was due to the support of Division of Highways, West Virginia Division of Highways, as well as the Historic Preservation Office. And so I think when there's sufficient support and commitment, you can produce some really good research in an applied context, which is what cultural resource management is. It's conducting studies within an impact zone, whether it be a gas pipeline right of way or a new road alignment or any other number of impacts, and you can achieve some really good things in terms of research results that provide windows into the collective past of West Virginia that are important in the long run and give us a better understanding of past lifeways and perspective.
Okay, well, since you were just talking about perspectives, you have some aerial photography from looks like an airplane. You know, people are just using their own personal drones 20 years later, but you do include aerial photography that gives a new understanding of, the top of the hill's fairly level, and as you go east, it's a little bit hilly, but it's not the same backbreaking approaches, marching up the hill carrying a bag of shells. But
right.
Your photography from various angles, I assume you probably took one shot from the Mingo Junction exit entrance ramp onto Route 7 for like a side view of the hill and the smokestacks in front of it, and the aerial photography, the color coded maps that show the density of artifacts. So you're incorporating all kinds of higher resolution photography, aerial photos. You're giving.
Yeah, we were using some new methodologies there. I mean, today you can use a drone and get aerial views of an archaeological site. Back then, of course, 20 years ago, we didn't have drones, but we did. I went up in a little single prop plane and took overviews of the site, and that gives you a good perspective of that. But this is actually one of the first sites where we were using electronic survey equipment called total stations, and what that did was that allowed us to lay out our archaeological grid to guide our excavations, but also to create provenience data, the locations of where artifacts were being recovered, and then we used that data, coupled that data with geographic information or GIS technology to produce distributional maps, electronic distributional maps, to show where artifacts and different kinds of food remains were being found, as well as the different kinds of pit features and burials were found in relation to the Midden. Prior to that, a lot of that work was being done by hand, but suddenly we were incorporating a lot of electronic technologies, which are standard today, but they were pretty new back in 1999 and 2000. So there were some new facets to the way we were doing archaeology that hadn't been used before. And on sites of such size, like East Steubenville and the site just north of it, Highland Hills, those kinds of technologies make it easier to understand spatial patterning and to illustrate it as a way to better understand what was going on at the site.
You know what, Mark? I want to say something. I want to say something about John Lothrop, because he won't say it, so I will. John has kind of always been at the forefront, and he's led us that way too. He's led us to understand and incorporate some of these technologies. So John would never say that about himself. So I'll say it, that he's always been, at least I believe, he's always been at the head of the game.
Well, thank you, John.
You got me a lot.
Okay. Leads into one of the questions I was hoping to get to. Might as well do it now. So, Lisa, how did this experience help you to develop this career you have going in archaeology, and Marina is supposed to be listening, so she's on a dig right now.
Hi, Marina.
As well, so yeah, she's continued her career. I can ask John if he's found anything over in Fort Steuben, since they have an ongoing dig as well. So, my question is, how did this experience 20 years ago help you today?
Lise, you go first.
Okay. So working at the East Steubenville site was really an amazing experience. I mean, we were there from, I don't know, the dead of winter through the heat of summer back into almost the dead of winter. And it was just like we made it through the whole excavation process, even on the cold, snowy days. We had our shelters. We had ways to keep warm. We had our little propane heaters, you know, and even the blazing hot summer days, you know, seeking shade like where we could whenever we were stripping the site. There was just, there was a lot of like really great fun that we had out there, and we did it like in a way that was just very, I felt very smart. And every day that I was out there, I felt like I was learning something new, and I really felt like I was contributing to something like the greater good. You know, because like John was saying, that site was going to be destroyed one way or another because of the highway project. And we were there getting information from it and doing it the best way we could. You know, so that part of it, the fieldwork part of it, was really great. I got to learn so much out there. I got to use the total station for mapping, and John helped me with that, John Bullidge. And I would, you know, use the total station and collect data with that. And then whenever we got back into the lab, I mean, I think we probably worked maybe 3 years like doing lab work and analysis after the year of excavation out there. So we learned a lot about like the artifacts that we were recovering, and with me working with Harold Rollins and learning about the shell and doing habitat reconstruction and how like the different databases that you want to find and report on, like the whole thing just like opened my eyes to what can be done after you're done in the field. So working with the shell and also with the faunal remains kind of put me on a path to learn more about zooarchaeology. And it was just great. And like, beyond that, I got to experience, you know, leading crews and continuing to do the kind of work that we did at Follansbee. And still to this day, I use, like, the information that I used at Follansbee to, like, build my projects. So, you know, as far as the field work goes, I kind of model what I do after what I learned from working at Follansbee. So it still helps me on like my projects now, but it definitely changed like my path, because at the time, 4 weeks, I think I was told the project was going to last 4 weeks. They're like, we have 4 weeks of work for you. It's real close to your house. Do you want to do it? And I was like, sure, this will be great. And that 4 weeks turned into another 4 weeks and another 4 weeks, and it just kept rolling. So, you know, I learned a lot about data control and, like, having, like, solid methodology for whenever you enter the field, having a good game plan so that you can build on that data, so that whenever you get out of the field, you can look at it and make sense out of it. I know that sounds like a real simple thing, Like, of course, that's what you do. But if you don't have that methodology set up in the beginning, it's kind of a nightmare whenever you get out of the field. So it definitely put me on a different path, because I wasn't sure at the time that I was going to stay in archaeology. But that project really, really helped me kind of figure out what I wanted to do and where I wanted to go. How about
okay,
you, John?
Well, thank you. You know, there were so many things that have helped mold where I went with archaeology. And once again, like Lisa said, a lot of that stems from eStudent. And one of the things that I really enjoyed, and one of the things that I took with me, aside from the tutelage of the PI that was on the job, was that also there was this met some of the most interesting people that you could ever imagine. And I laugh and joke, and these people who were there represented some of the best field people around. I don't know this for a fact, but I often wonder, and probably shouldn't answer this, John, but I often wonder if they were handpicked, which, you know, wouldn't be right to do. But having said that, a lot of these people represented excellent field archaeologists. And to get a chance to work with them and to see how they worked and to see how they did things was a huge benefit for me, because, you know, I had worked for some other companies, and some of the people I met in various other companies, the caliber of quality may or may not have been high, you know, but the folks that I met at East Steubenville, I learned so much from watching them, and not just watching them, but interacting with them. And I had the opportunity to work with several people up there as partners, including Lisa. And, you know, you just learn so much and incorporate their techniques with your techniques. And I'd like to hope that some of them may have learned some things from me, but, you know, that isn't as important to me as watching and learning, you know, different ideologies. And so that to me was incredibly valuable. And the other part of that is, in my current career, I deal with lots of similar individuals, all with various personalities, some great, some not so great. And, you know, working up there in all those conditions, hot, cold, rainy, snowy, wet, muddy, poison ivy covered test units, working in those conditions and learning how to move around various personalities, you know, to all accomplish the same goal, I think is a very important skill that I brought with me out of there. So that's not the kind of thing you think of when you think of archaeology, is your people communication skills. But, you know, man, you need that. You need that in this field, you know, because ultimately a lot of what I do, at least in my my end of the archaeological spectrum, is I refer to myself oftentimes as a bureaucratic archaeologist. I deal with a lot of people who may or may not understand the importance of archaeology. So I learned a lot from working with those individuals.
Okay. So what are you observing at Fort Steuben? Phil Fitzgibbons was on WTOV a couple weeks ago talking about a new dig they have going on. They're finding some colonial bottles and that kind of stuff, some pottery. What's going on with the summer's dig?
So Fort Steuben is a pretty interesting place to conduct historic archaeology, because, you know, there is you've got all the time frames kind of represented. We have a prehistoric component there, as well as the early you know, colonial / federalist period / on up through the Civil War, post-Civil War, World War I, World War II, on up to modern day. All of those time periods are available for analysis there at Fort Steuben's excavations. So it's really interesting that, you know, a lot of the fort-related material is, for understandable reasons, the fort wasn't occupied for all that long, so those materials have a tendency to be relatively scarce and not as easy to come by. lot of the other material really shows the growth and the expansion that Steubenville, how Steubenville expanded, grew throughout the time period. And you can see that, the way the industry flourished. And then you can even see it kind of come to an end, you know, all of you know, kind of industry. So it's a really good place to conduct that kind of work. And also, too, being that it's a teaching facility, it's really interesting there as well, because the materials in historic archaeology, in that aspect at Fort Stevens, historic archaeology are artifacts that you can recognize. So if someone who doesn't have a background in archaeology or you're volunteering, it's easy for you to recognize a lot of those artifacts because they are things that are kind of contemporaneous with your own life. Oftentimes we find folks that are fresh into the field that have a difficult time identifying a lot of prehistoric artifacts because they just haven't had the experience going over those materials time and time and time again. And in Fort Steuben, that's not as huge of a deal, although sometimes, you know, you obviously, something's a piece of metal, it's what that piece of metal may have been used for example, sometimes becomes more problematic. So, and then when we fall back into those artifacts that sort of date to the time of the fort, you know, once again, most of those are relatively recognizable, a gun flint or a military coat button or even a coin, you know, an old coin dating to that time period. So that's kind of in a nutshell what goes on there at Steubenville. Professor Fitzgibbons, who was also my professor going up through the ranks, I worked at Fort Steuben a lot. Now, I don't currently work there as an archaeologist, but I do help them out with various festivals and education programs, giving presentations here and there, as well as doing some of their blacksmithing. So, you know, I do have an affiliation with Fort Steuben.
Okay, and Jonathan, you're working on a project now. What is your latest project?
I'm at the New York State Museum, and so the research that I'm doing now, it's sort of the frame of reference has shifted. When I was working at GAI, I was working at on archaeological projects and mostly in the Ohio Valley, and now I've shifted to working in New York, and I'm, instead of these hunter-gatherer populations from 5,000-6,000 years ago, we're studying the earliest Native American peoples to come into the New York region about 13,000 years ago in the late Ice Age, and trying to understand how they're making a living in what was essentially a subarctic environment and climate and landscape with animals like mastodon, caribou running around the region at that time, and how they were affected by relatively abrupt climate change at the end of the Ice Age about 11,500 years ago, when it goes from cold and dry to warm and very dry. And so that's been my main focus for the last several years.
Okay. And Lisa, you've done some work in the Allegheny River Valley. Are you noticing any differences, like, you know, between the shells and the two different, there are two different river valleys, but they're still connected. You know, is there any differences or just a continuation of many of the same traits that you saw in the Upper Ohio River Valley on other, you know, these other projects you've worked on in the Allegheny River Valley?
That's a really interesting question. So in terms,
that's why I paid a lot of money to do this.
Clearly. In terms of the types of shell, like the individual little critters that we find, it's pretty much the same species that we come across. there will be different amounts. Like with Bolensby, we had the spike in the elephant ear. But at some of the other locations, those weren't as common. We would have more of these little Pleurobema shells. And these Pleurobema are more like, they're called hickory nuts or pig's toes. So it really, and we also have those at East Steubenville. They just weren't the most prominent ones. So there's a, you come across the same species, but in different quantities at different locations. So that's where the greatest difference is in terms of the actual fish that they're, shellfish that they're harvesting for food. And then with shell use, like the shell pools that we had at East Steubenville were really different than anything I've seen anywhere else. I've come across the shells that have notching in them, but not the notching like we saw at East Steubenville, where it looked like there was something that we call bipolar notching, and that would be notches on opposite ends of the shell that looked like it might have been used for hafting. And then the shell edge was used for scraping. So we saw that at East Steubenville, but I haven't seen that anywhere else. I've seen the drilled shells that would be used for perhaps pendants or something like that at other places, but nothing like the scrapers that we identified.
If I can just follow up on that, Mark. So Lisa was originally, after we got out of the field, and after all the archaeological material was processed and cleaned in the lab, Lisa was tasked with analyzing the shellfish remains at the site, working under the guidance of Harold Rollins at University of Pittsburgh. And her main goals there were to classify, taxonomically classify the shellfish at the site as evident and as indicators of what specific species we're going after, and then understand it from a habitat perspective, which would provide insight on where the shell was actually being gathered and then carried back up to the site. But in the course of doing that work, Lisa pointed out to me that these shells, many of them were actually showed evidence of modification, which is something that had never been identified on a panhandle archaic site in northern West Virginia before. And so some of these shells are being modified perhaps for purposes of personal adornment. They were also being, there's also evidence that they were being used as tools themselves, which was a big surprise. And at first I was very skeptical, but then she was showing me these modifications, and she then supported those identifications through experimental work, replicating the modifications that we're seeing on the shell. So this is really groundbreaking research beyond just the basic biological studies of the shellfish themselves. She was showing that they were actually part of the material culture of these panhandle archaic Native Americans who were living at East Steubenville. And that's just one example of some of the innovative insights that came out of the project. And that's all to Lisa's credit.
Thanks, John. Oh, shucks.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
No, I was saying I could almost see Lisa blushing.
Yep.
One of the interesting things about the book, the GAI book on the East Steubenville dig was the book Fishes of Ohio by Milton Troutman, and you did bring up the possibility of the paddlefish possibly people fishing for those larger type fish. You know, it's pretty strange looking. I don't know, like it's almost like some kind of prehistoric fish. But you know, there were a few harpoons found. Yeah, these people were doing some serious fishing.
That's right, and that's, again, as I said before, that's one of the distinctive aspects of this site and other archaic shellman sites from 5,000 to 4,000 years ago in the Upper Ohio Valley. Is they've changed their life way from strictly terrestrial hunting and gathering to turning towards riverine resources, both shellfish and fish. And Stephen Thomas did the detailed study of the fish bones at the site, and what it showed was that they were routinely or primarily catching channel catfish, who was the dominant species. And that and the studies of other food remains at the site gave insights into the seasonality of encampments at the site. So what Stephen did was he looked at an incremental growth ring analysis on the vertebrae of these channel catfish. It's like tree rings, and he was able to determine that these fish were being taken in their early rapid growth phase in the warm season, and that would have been late spring to early summer. And so that told you that that time of year, late spring to early summer, that made sense because that's when these channel catfish are spawning, and often they get caught in floods up onto river terraces, and they can be literally harvested after getting caught on river terraces that get flooded in these spring floods. And there are other food remains, the shellfish that Lisa studied. The assumption is that they would have been harvested primarily in the summer and early fall when the river, instead of at the spring when it's at its high level in the summer, early fall, then it's at its lowest level, and that's when it's easiest to harvest shellfish that are living on these riffles in what would have been the Ohio River, would have been a shallower river back then. But the contrast to this is the faunal remains, the animal bone remains, and the botanical remains that were recovered at the site. So, for example, the plant remains that Justine McKnight identified, they were dominated by carbonized hulls of black walnut and hickory, as well as carbonized seeds, and then fleshy fruits like cherry, elder, sumac, grape, and blackberry. And all these plant foods would have been harvested from late summer into fall. And then conversely, the animal terrestrial animal remains at the site that were analyzed by Sissy Pipes, they were heavily dominated by white-tailed deer. Not a surprise there, but that provided other seasonal insights into occupations at the site. They were most likely would have been hunted in the late fall. And so what that tells you is that these people, the inhabitants of the East Steubenville site, were coming here in the spring and early summer for fishing of channel catfish. In the summer and early fall, they were collecting shellfish. In the summer and fall, they're harvesting wild fruits and grains and nuts. And in the fall and the winter, they're deer hunting. So it isn't evidence that the people are living there year-round, but they're strategically coming back to the site in all these different seasons to harvest these different food resources. And so it gives you an understanding of how the site's being used at different times in the year, and gives you a more complex perspective on how these people are making a living 5,000 years ago in the Upper Ohio Valley.
You know something, Mark, too, with what John said, one thing we tend to not think about the way people utilize those resources was we never think about what people liked. And, you know, sometimes, you know, you got to put that human spin on it. And it's really interesting. You had mentioned paddlefish. Lisa had mentioned, mm-hmm. 14 species of mussel. But two species of mussel were predominant, as well as catfish being the most predominant species. Now, some of that may have been because, you know, perhaps those other species were easy to get to or whatever. But we have to stop and think that maybe those things represented preferred foods. Just like nowadays, you know, nobody wants to eat their vegetables, but everybody's going to eat that cheese. And I really, a lot of times when we see these kinds of references, you know, granted, you know, if you're starving, you're going to eat anything, and we do that now. But, you know, I think, you know, to put that human spin on it, that these are people, and these are people that did stuff. You know, they did exactly like us. They, you know, had the same kind of ideal, maybe not the same ideology, but they were just like us biologically. And, you know, I always like to kind of liken those predominant species as maybe the more preferred species, not species by chance, like, say, maybe the paddlefish or, you know, something like that. You come by, yes, big fish are going to eat it, and maybe it just didn't taste as good as those channel cats. So, you know, and that's what we keep coming back to. But that's just conjecture on my part.
No, it makes sense. And they had it seems other than bivouacs on the hillside, on top of the hill, you know, wherever they set up their homes. Aside from that, it seems like the only man-made structure there was a smoke rack, and one of the people who's really interested in listening to this show, Laura, I told Laura, it's positioning on the west side of the hill. Seems like it's all set up to, you know, keep the embers going for food, preparation. You know, I told her, it's probably very similar to the air fryer that you're famous for using. So, I don't know if she's going to boycott the show for that comment, but it really does sound like they had, you know, that invention kind of getting started 5,000 years, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago.
I will say this, that whatever their proclivity was for choosing the site, and, you know, John may want to chime in on that as well, but certainly I can attest that during the summer it was warm up there. springtime was relatively pleasant, but there always did seem to be a breeze, and that breeze got to be very annoying when it got cold out. So, you know, especially after in the final stages of our project, you know, that wind was cold.
Brutal.
It was very cold.
It was brutal.
Yes, it was.
Okay, and unfortunately we only have 20 more minutes left, but John, I didn't want to get into your tour last week of Barnesville's Track Rocks. That's a lot more recent than the East Steubenville site, but it does show how long the Native American population was living in the greater Ohio Valley. What was, for the listeners, could you explain the importance of the track rocks and what they would have been meaning with these petroglyphs? How do we read them? What are they saying to us?
Well, ultimately, it's impossible to put ourselves in the mind of that prehistoric person who inscribed those rock petroglyphs, 800-plus years ago. So it's really difficult to know exactly what they're saying. But, one thing that they are saying is that, hey, we were here, that's evident. Many people have interpreted track rocks as being a place, an education place, some place to teach and talk about the various types of animals or perhaps clans that, might be associated with those animal tracks. Track rocks got its name from the abundance of animal tracks that are incised into the rocks. There's turkey tracks, bear tracks, human tracks, elk, deer, in various places across the rocks, as well as lots of other symbols and various things, some snakes and things like that across the rocks. So that's how it got its name. It's probably one of the, in my humble opinion, it's probably one of the better petroglyph sites in Ohio. And it is currently owned and managed by the Archaeological Conservancy, so it is private property. You can't go up there. But there are folks interested in eventually having that open to the public. So we'll see. But Track Rock itself is an interesting array of large tabular pieces of sandstone that are lying on a very high ridge, kind of in the middle of nowhere. That were very attractive to these folks because they are like a great big table, and it's very easy to stand around that table and see those tracks on those rocks. So I think that might have been the initial reason why people went there. Now, the reasons and the meanings behind the inscriptions, like I said, I don't know that we will ever know that. We can make attempts at interpretation, and I liken those areas. Many people will say those areas are ceremonial or cultural, perhaps is a better term. But and then they ask, what are these places for? And I always kind of liken them to churches. We go to church. Uh-huh. Not just to pray, but oftentimes we go to church for spaghetti dinners, for bingo, for weddings, flea markets, so they're not necessarily
socializing.
Yeah, exactly. They're a linchpin for your group, for your society, for your community. And I look at track rocks as being one of those linchpins, someplace that kept that community anchored, someplace to go and be who they were.
John, is there a strategic aspect to the location of the track rocks in terms of the surrounding landscape?
No, it doesn't appear to be, meaning that it's actually quite high above the nearest creek, which is a small little tributary. It's actually I'd say it's much higher than it's at least in the 300-foot distance above that creek, but it's also quite a ways back the ridge system. To my knowledge, there's no other forms of water around. It seems to be sort of an isolated location. The most interesting thing about it is because those rocks seem to outcrop there and not on any of the adjacent ridges, at least that we're aware of. The area had been actually heavily strip mined in the 40s and 50s, so there may very well have been other locations of people there, and this is the only one still extant. However, there is a rock shelter very close by, a large rock shelter that's on private property, and I've yet to gain access to that to see that. That may very well have brought people there as well. But I will also note that scattered in and around the area, there are some other late prehistoric archaeological sites, including one that's the National Register called the Tower Site. which is probably, as the crow flies, about 2 miles away. So that may have some relevance as well. But no, any other sort of aside from the fact that those rocks just don't seem like they should be there, what makes it such an interesting location?
Hmm. Yeah, they seem like they were just kind of dumped out in a field.
That's exactly what it looks like. There's just a series of really large sandstone tablets, in laying in this particular area. So it's pretty interesting. And like I said, the petroglyphs on them themselves are really, really interesting. Like I said, you also get a few drawings of faces as well, but the tracks are certainly the thing that stands out the most.
Okay. And,
very interesting.
That's a neat place.
It really is. And, hopefully, one of the things that I find, and, I'm very passionate about sharing archaeology with people. And archaeologists, and John and Lisa will attest to this, when you put us in a room and usually imbibe us with beer, we will talk for hours and hours about archaeology. And we will pontificate and we will argue and we will, basically tell each other we're wrong or we're right or we'll agree or disagree. But in the end, we're archaeologists talking to archaeologists. And that's not terribly interesting for people like everyday folks. Everybody's interested in archaeology, but sometimes we have a habit that bad habit of only speaking archaeology. And one of my passions is to speak English and translate archaeology. So I'm really passionate about sharing archaeology and prehistory and primitive, I hate that term, that's not the right term, past life ways with folks. How did these people make a living? And not so much concentrate on a lot of the minutia of the way we do things, but obviously talk about that, but talk more about the people, talk more about the prehistoric people and how they did things, and I find that a lot of people are really interested in that. And that's kind of something that I've kind of taken up on my own, sharing and talking with people. I give a lot of presentations about such things, and that's something I'm very, very passionate about. Is that if we want archaeology to be important and preserved, we have to talk to people who aren't other archaeologists. And like I said, Lisa and John and myself, we do that a lot. But I think it's something that other archaeologists need to get more comfortable with and understand that while these people, normal everyday folks, are interested in archaeology, they just don't speak archaeologist. And we use different terminology to explain different things. And I think that a lot of archaeologists are missing opportunities to share our passions about this field.
Indeed.
And Lisa, you have also been on the lecture circuit as well.
Sure.
And you have
a
great presentation on Betty Broyles. We only have like 10, 11 minutes left, can you give us a synopsis of her importance to archaeology and her influence on you?
Yeah, so Betty Broyles was an archaeologist who worked all over the eastern United States. She did a lot of work in the southeast, but most of her work was in West Virginia. And she came up in the 50s, and she did a lot of work in the 50s and 60s when there weren't a lot of other women doing archaeology. And she encountered some difficulties early in her career when she was working at the Illinois State Museum. She was told that she could be on a field crew, but she could never lead a field crew. So shortly thereafter, she got a job in West Virginia and eventually became the state archaeologist for West Virginia. And her work at the State Albans or the St. Albans site produced one of the best sequential projectile point typologies that we have right now. And a lot of the typologies that we use, a lot of the way we date artifacts is somewhat based on what she found. And one of the things that, like, I had always heard of, like, whenever I was working, you know, in the field and as a technician early on in my career was I'd heard about St. Albans points all over the place. But I had never, like, knew where they were named from or who was involved in naming them or any of that until much later in my career. And that's how I became acquainted with Betty Broyles. But that typology that was created from this archaeology, because it had a very clear sequence and it was also supported by radiocarbon dating. So you have the points in a very clearly stratified site, like the layers were very clear and isolated, and you have radiocarbon with it. So that's one of the things that, like, I found to be very important, and very few people, at least as far as I knew, in terms of, like, technicians and people out in the field, didn't really know where that information came from, didn't attribute it to Betty, and to know how difficult it was for her to become a state archaeologist and the events in her career that led her there. So she did a lot of work in West Virginia, and it's really interesting because when I was researching her life, I came up across an article that was right next to an article about her, and it was about another woman who was a professional. She was a professional engineer in Colorado, and at the same time, this woman in Colorado had been fighting for 2 years to access her project, where she was the lead engineer for building a tunnel. And she had to fight in court to be allowed to go into the project area. And the first day she goes into the project area, the entire crew left because she was there. And meanwhile, right next to that article is this article. So it was just a very interesting thing to think about, you know, the things that she had to encounter and the things that other women were encountering at that time to be professional, to be somebody in science, and to be accepted as an equal. So, yeah, so Betty's kind of one of my personal heroes.
Okay. You gave a captivating lecture on her a few months ago.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I also talk a lot about the shell from East Steubenville. I usually have like one talk a year about that. So so it'll be coming up again soon.
Okay. Well, your talk tonight was equally as informative. And Jonathan, do you have a new publication coming out soon? Your Paleo Point article was really, you know, had a chance to skim through a little bit of it today, but I enjoyed it. Are you working on something else for publication soon, or you're just doing something at the museum?
Yes, actually, I do, and it's in a sense a So I'm working in New York State, and back in 1965, the former state archaeologist Bill Ritchie published a book called The Archaeology of New York State, and that's several decades ago now, and I recently contributed a chapter to a reset of our understanding of New York State archaeology and center. So I wrote a synthetic chapter on the earliest peoples in the region, these that archaeologists call Paleo-Indians, these Native Americans that came into the region during the Ice Age. And so that's a chapter that's forthcoming. It's going to be coming out this fall in a open access book that will be available for free on the New York State Museum website through their publication series called the New York State Museum Record. And so that synthesizes the current information we have on these in terms of archaeological evidence for these earliest peoples in the New York region. So that's coming out later this year. I would expect that by December that'll be available for download for free.
Wow. Okay. I'll have to look for that. So if people are looking for something to do for the second half of the summer, they can stop at Fort Steuben, see John on the weekends, and what else is going on in Albany at the New York State Museum?
Well, we do archaeological excavations there. My colleague Michael Lucas, the historical archaeology curator, is working on a free black farmstead called the Powell Site, and he's been conducting field work on that. And we're actually working, or have been working, on a Paleo-Indian site, a 12,500-year-old site in the Mohawk Valley near Utica, New York, called the Quarter Tape Site, and we were there in May and just finished up some field work last week, and might be going back there in the fall, and people can volunteer for that as well if they're interested.
Wow. Okay. Neat stuff. Lisa, how about you? What do you have going on now once you get back from vacation?
Well, I actually have a bunch of field work going on right now, and we're doing phase one archaeology that's the shovel test pits for a site in Mercer County. And we are also doing a architectural survey for underrepresented properties in Western Pennsylvania.
Hmm.
So,
okay.
Yeah, it's really interesting, exciting stuff.
Sounds like it. Okay. So, yeah, we have like 90 seconds left. I guess we can probably start wrapping things up there. Lisa said this was a great reunion, and it sounded like, yeah, you could just tell by your voices that you enjoyed reminiscing. And I thought it was a terrific show. And thank you so much for being part of Nightlight and helping me with my projects as well. It's just been a terrific collaboration, and we'll have to do this again sometime soon. I thought it was a wonderful evening with the three of you as our panel of experts.
Thanks for organizing it, Mark. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah,
great. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you for the invitation.
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
It was wonderful to talk with everyone.
I'm sure the listeners got a lot out of it. So, Barbara has a great show lined up for tomorrow, and we'll see everyone at noon tomorrow with Andrew Collins.